I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to Radio Times. Heroin deaths have increased dramatically in the last 15 years, spurred in part by addiction to prescription painkillers like OxyContin, Percocet, and Vicodin. The CDC says that white males aged 18 to 25 living in large metropolitan areas are at the greatest risk for heroin addiction. Pennsylvania has the highest rate of drug overdose among this age group in the country, and Bucks County leads the state. New Jersey is number four in the nation, with Gloucester County having the highest heroin overdose rate in that state. Today on Radio Times, we want to take a hard look at heroin addiction, its effect on drug users, their families, and their communities. We'll discuss the science of addiction and the various treatment options that are available. And we have a trio of guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studio. Kathy Messina is founder of DAVE, which stands for Drug Addiction Overdose Education Incorporated. DAVE was founded in memory of her son David, who lost his battle with drug addiction in February 2014. The Bucks County organization trains and distributes naloxone to friends and family members of those who have struggled with addiction. And Kathy Messina, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Also with us is Elvis Rosado. He was addicted to heroin. He sold drugs. He spent some time in prison, time in rehab, and now works as education coordinator at Prevention Point Philly, and that's a public health organization working to reduce drug use for high-risk populations. Elvis Rosado, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Pleasure. Thank you.
You're welcome. And rounding out our trio of guests is Charles O'Brien, and he is a professor of psychiatry and the founding director of the Center for the Studies of Addiction at the University of Pennsylvania. And Charles O'Brien, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well. Elvis, let me begin with you and begin with a little bit of your story. When did you start using drugs?
I started using at an early age as an adolescent. My father had turned me on to the minors, and then it just continued to progress from there and developed into a full-fledged addiction.
So it turned you on to the minors? What,
yes.
Like marijuana?
Marijuana, drinking, okay. You know, methamphetamine at the time, because cocaine had not flooded the communities yet, but...
Why did your father do that?
He was an addict himself.
And he wanted his son to do drugs.
Yes, he
with
wanted
him?
Company. So it was something that, you know, it still baffles me today. I still don't understand what, because I have two older brothers and they've never used, they don't smoke, they don't drink anything. So it was something that it became a partnership between us, I guess, and it progressed into horrible things and, you know, horrible situations.
Which I assume includes using the drugs,
using,
what it takes
selling,
to get the drugs.
Yes.
And you got addicted to heroin?
Yes. After a while, by the time I hit 18 and was in my 20s, I was addicted to heroin. I ended up on the streets for about a year and a half, living in abandoned buildings. And it was something that I had the option to go home, but going home meant not using. So for me at the time, it wasn't an option.
But was going home where your father was?
Well, no, at the time, my mom had, they had already separated and divorced. But it was, you know, it was going home to my mom's. But it was still at this point, you know, it's all I knew, the streets and the drugs. So,
and for you at that time in your life, it was all about getting heroin?
It was all about getting,
it
was about everything, because it was heroin, it was cocaine, it was marijuana, you know, anything and everything. The way that right now we see a huge influx of opiate pills, back then it was syrup. They used to, the codeine syrups used to be sold, and that was mostly what people were abusing. So it became a daily thing. I mean, and it was all about acquiring it. How was I going to acquire
high.
It? Yeah, and getting high.
And what did getting high, what did that feel like for you?
It was. It's not even a feeling as much as it is a separation from reality. It was a numbing feeling. It was not having to feel, not having to have to think or. It's interesting, because one of the difficulties sometimes in addiction is that it is easier to stay in the pain and the addiction, because you already know what tomorrow brings. You know what your day tomorrow is going to look like. But sobriety is a constant. You don't know what tomorrow's day is going to be like.
It's harder.
And it's a lot harder to deal with the unknown than it is to know what the year is going to look like. So some people tend to prefer to stay in that.
So we're talking, what, 25 years ago, something like that?
Yes. Yes, I have currently 23 years of sobriety now.
Congratulations on that. If we were to have seen you then 25 years ago, what would we have seen? Who would we have seen?
A broken soul. I weighed probably about 115 pounds, 120 pounds.
So really thin.
Scruffy, tired, depressed, angry. I was a very angry individual at the time.
Did you fight with people?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that was a common reality. It's difficult because you want help, but you don't take it. And then it's a constant battle with fighting with people who, whether it's drug related, whether it's money related, whether it's trying to defend yourself because of where you're at, fighting with individuals who want to help you and are trying to point out the fact that, you know, you're living a self-destructive life. And it was constantly that, you know, so it's a constant battle.
Yeah. And I do want to get to Kathy, but I do want to have our listeners sort of know how, at least for you, Elvis, how this ended, which is you got yourself sober, so
yes,
to speak.
So I had made a promise to myself that the day I brought a child into this world, my life would change. I didn't want to be my father. So after I was incarcerated, I found out my son's mother was pregnant, and that was my turning point. I had decided at that point that, you know, it was time to change my life, and I kicked my habit in prison cold turkey, which was not the most pleasant thing.
I can't imagine.
But again, I had a conversation with my cellmate, who was also a heroin addict, who was also going through withdrawals, and he was going and getting medicated for every little, you know, discomfort that he felt. And he kept telling me that I should do the same. But at one point I said to him, when you leave here, are you taking the nurse with you? And he said, no, obviously. And then I said, so how are you going to deal with these anxieties and everything else? And he said, oh, I'll just go to the corner and I'll buy a Xanax or I'll get a joint or whatever. And I said, and that's what I don't want to do.
Yeah.
Needless to say, 6 months after he was released, he died of an overdose.
Wow. But for you, this was... just an actual turning point for
yes.
you. And just, I am just not going to do, I'm
yes.
not going to repeat what my father did,
yes.
and I'm not going to do drugs anymore.
And I needed to make sure that I set an example for my son and that he would not have to experience anything. I refused to allow the streets to consume him. To me, that was my mission. I couldn't allow that.
And we should say that your son is 23 years old.
Yes.
And he listens to Radio
and
Times.
And he's a graduate of Penn State main campus.
Well, congratulations on that. I mean, that's
the pride of my life.
Absolutely. And I'll get back to you. But let me turn to you, Kathy. And you have this is a sad story. You lost your son, David, to heroin, to a drug overdose.
Yes, I did.
Did you know he was using? Did you know he was addicted?
Right before he overdosed. Shortly before, we found out that he had a problem, and we were in the midst of trying to get him help when, you know, the night happened. He didn't get that far into any type of recovery. We had him on what I called our own house arrest,
right,
where we were watching him and everything. David's not the typical stereotypical person you looked at and said he's a drug user. He was the kindest kid. He wasn't an angry child. He did lose some weight. I mean, looking back, I can see where there were signs. He was caught lying a lot, where that was not him typically, and I couldn't understand it. And I actually was angry that he was doing it because he was a terrible liar because he would always get caught. And that's what I always told him, that he didn't get caught right then, but he would always get caught. And so.
Do you know when he started using?
Not exactly. No, because we didn't get that far into it. I mean, as far as I know, he passed away in February. I believe that it was the summer. But it could have started way before that. I have no idea.
In fact, you found him in your house.
I found my son. Yeah, the night it happened, we were all home except for two of my sons. My one son was away at school, and my other son went to a hockey game, and everyone else was home. And we had a family dinner, sat down and had a great family dinner. Everybody was joking. I have a job. I work at home, so I was upstairs working. And David, my younger daughter had to make something for a service corps for school the next day, brownies. And my David came up to me and said, "I'll make the brownies, Mom." And I thought that was wonderful. And I said, "Really?" I said, "Really, Dave, you're really going to make it? Because I don't want to. I'm me making brownies at 10 o'clock at night." And he goes, "No, I'll do it. There's a mix downstairs. I'll do it." Huh. So that's what I thought he was doing. The girls went into their rooms to go to bed and stuff. And the story goes is I didn't smell the brownies.
So you knew that the brownies were not being cooked?
And that's why I went downstairs to check on him. And he was in the bathroom, and I yelled into the bathroom and went back upstairs. I told him to get his act together and make the brownies. The brownie mix was sitting on the island waiting. I went back upstairs, and like maybe 10 minutes went by, and I didn't smell it again. So I went downstairs, and then the panic started because I thought, did he run out of the house? Did something happen? I didn't hear. So I checked the basement because there's a way to get out of the basement. He wasn't there, and I went back. The bathroom door was closed the whole time, and I guess I just didn't want to think he was in the bathroom. Mm-hmm. And that's when I looked under the door, and I felt him.
Oh, you saw him there.
And I screamed for my husband, who fell asleep on the couch, and he came out. And part of the story is I ran upstairs to get my older son, and he was actually overdosing also in his bedroom. So David was downstairs in the bathroom, and my other son was upstairs. And obviously David didn't make it.
Yeah. Such a sad story, and I'm so sorry, and I appreciate you telling us, and I know how difficult it must be for you to tell us as well. And it was a mix of what, heroin and fentanyl, you were telling us.
Yes. We actually found the heroin, and it had bad news stamped on the back of it, which was said to have the fentanyl. So I have no idea what happened that my one son made it and my other son didn't. I don't know if he took more. I have no idea because questions didn't ask, you know. But
how is your son doing, the one who?
Excellent. He went right into a rehab. He's doing the program. He's doing everything he's supposed to do. He's working full time. He's doing really good.
Well, that's great to know. And we're going to take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. And Charles O'Brien, I'm going to put some questions to you right after this short break. But I wanted to make sure our listeners heard from people who have lived through this situation and have had family members deal with the problem of heroin addiction, also who have experienced them themselves. So we're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe, and we are talking about heroin and opioid addiction with our three guests. We heard from Elvis Rosado, education coordinator at Prevention Point Philly, also with Kathy Messina, founder of DAVE, Drug Addiction Overdose Education Incorporated. And now I do want to turn to our other guest, Charles O'Brien. He is a professor of psychiatry, founding director of the Center for for Studies of Addiction at the University of Pennsylvania. And Charles, we've had a chance to hear both Elvis and Kathy tell their stories. And these are such important stories, I think, for all of us to hear. And I think many people are surprised to know that heroin addiction is back. Not that it ever went away, but somehow it has returned. Is it through opioids and the kind of prescription drugs that we're all familiar with?
Yes, it's actually both of those were very sad stories, but it never went away. And I originally got into this field because of another opioid epidemic during the Vietnam War when I was a member of the United States Navy as a physician. And that's how I was confronted with learning how to treat it. And we did develop some really good treatments, some really good medications, but we haven't done a very good job of moving that into medical education. So your average physician really doesn't know much about addiction and the treatment of addiction.
Even today.
Even today. That's a major part of my time these days, trying to teach doctors about addiction, all kinds of addiction, because we know more about other drugs and even non-drugs like internet addiction and gambling. But the problem of opiate addiction is causing us to lose more people to overdose, like you heard here, than traffic accidents.
Something, a very sobering thought, if I can use that word. Help us, though, understand this is the kind of disease model. I think probably back in the previous generations, maybe even during the Vietnam War, it was seen as a character issue. But today, we see it as a disease.
Yes? Absolutely. It's clearly a disease, and we actually learned that with all the research that started in the 1970s. And that has enabled us to develop new treatments. And one of the main messages I would like to leave the audience with is that we know more about addiction. There's a tremendous amount of science involved, and we know that the best treatment involves medication plus counseling. And not everyone realizes that. And if you exclude medication, especially for opiate addiction, the results of treatment are much, much less effective.
And what kind of medications are we talking about?
Well, we have a number of different kinds. First thing that the opioids are involved in the treatment of pain. And so that led to this resurgence of opioids. During the 90s, we were concerned that so many people with pain were not being treated. And we were pushing doctors to prescribe more opioids, but they weren't getting the education that they should. And so consequently, there were opioids on the street. People were using the prescription opioids. And when they ran out of that, they were relatively expensive, they would buy heroin on the street.
Which is cheap now, as I understand it.
Right. It's relatively cheap compared to the prescription opioids, and it's just as dangerous. So we have new medications. For example, we have medications like methadone, which has saved a lot of lives over the years, but so many people don't understand methadone. We have something which is a more flexible treatment called Suboxone, which has much less of a risk of overdose. And all of these enable people to lead a normal life. I mean, you know, I testified before Congress in Washington on this and actually brought some patients with me to demonstrate that people on methadone, people on Suboxone can function normally. And then we have opiate antagonists, which naloxone is an example, and you heard that saves a lot of lives. But a lot of doctors don't get taught about how to use naloxone and how it works. We also have naltrexone, which is like a long-acting version of naloxone, and we're using that more and more to prevent relapse. So we have a large study, which is about to be published, actually, of people who were getting out of prison, treated with naltrexone, and they can't relapse because the medication blocks the opiate receptor.
Well, Kathy, let me turn back to you because your group is involved in educating, first responders and others about naloxone. Why naloxone and what's your approach?
It all started out because my friend Denise, who's my partner in crime, per se, wanted to help me. I kind of knew something about naloxone when my son overdosed. I didn't know a lot, and I felt that if they came and they gave it to him, he'd be okay. I don't even know if they had it. And so it started out where I wanted it. And that's when we met Elvis, our angel. And I just think it's important that every family, anybody who has anybody or connections with anybody, have this to save a life. And some people say, well, why save the lives? Because there's a possibility you might save someone who overdosed who could turn around and just use again. But the fact is, if I can give them one more day to reach the bottom, then I'm going to give them. And if I have to save their life again the next day, we should have that in our power to save them. the next day.
And I noticed, I mean, a number of police departments and cities and communities are really behind naloxone and saying that we need to make this available. And it is what effect if someone is overdosing, that's when you use it.
Yes, it blocks it, so that you know, it stops the overdose from happening. Now they still have to go. They should still go to the hospital, and they still have to go through, because if you let them go and they use again right away, it can be deadly, because, you know, it's now you have twice as much in your system. So what we'd like to do is aim get people to have the naloxone, so if they can save a life,
right.
And also educate them, because I'm telling you, I wish I knew everything that I know now. And so many people and families are even afraid to speak out. And that's why I speak out, to hope that someone else will speak out, because we're better in numbers. And if you're suffering this alone, your family, it's not going to help. Like, you need to be educated.
Well, I thought it was so interesting when you said about your son, which is that he didn't fit the profile. Mm-hmm. And I wonder to you, Elvis, I mean, what is the profile? I mean, we probably have stereotypes, but clearly that's not an accurate picture.
The majority, yeah. I mean, I think everybody sees the homeless individual strung out on the street and a lot of times think this person brought on themselves, they should know better. But there is no picture. I had when I worked at, I won't name the hospital, but I worked at a hospital where I had a gentleman come in. He had been on the streets for 3 years. He was strung out. Typical addict individual. But when I sat down with him, he had been in the military 19 years, had a family, 3 beautiful kids, a home, stopped on 95 to change a tire, was hit by a car, broke his back, spent almost a year on morphine. And then when they finally discharged him, they gave him a handful of Percocets and sent him home. Never detoxed him, never did follow up. And apparently at some point ran into somebody who handed him a bag of heroin and that's it. He was done. You know, by the time he got to my office, he had lost everything, had been discharged from the military, everything. So there is no, per se, a picture that this happens in the inner city and it happens to poor kids. And it happens to everybody.
Well, and interestingly, you mentioned this, Charles O'Brien, which is that back in the 90s when more pain prescription was given out, the idea is that perhaps we can help people with their suffering. Is it there wasn't the kind of follow-through? Elvis talked about someone sort of being given a handful of Percocets or whatever and saying, you're cured now, go on with the rest of your life.
Pain is one of the most common symptoms that any doctor faces in his patients or her patients. And there's not enough training in how to treat pain. We don't just use medication. We have various kinds of physical therapy, group therapy, behavior therapy, and we have medication, but you have to know the pharmacology. For example, you were hearing about the way to use Narcan or naloxone. Right. It's a very short-acting medication, and you can't really hurt anybody with it. That's why we can give it to police, firemen, anybody. But it's a short-acting. That's good and bad. If they have taken something long-acting like methadone, overdosing on that, you give them the naloxone, they wake up, they're fine, and then you say, okay, go, and then the methadone kicks in again, and they overdose because it has a very short half-life.
Well, I wonder, too, just because you're here, and if we're talking about a disease, and perhaps it's a brain disease, so what happens to the brain? What does the brain look like when someone is, let's say, using heroin or perhaps even overusing prescription drugs?
Well, that's a good question. And unfortunately, you know, we teach it in great detail at the University of Pennsylvania, but most medical schools don't have a course on addiction. We know that, first of all, addiction is a learned behavior. It's very much involving the part of the brain that involves learning. And when you start using any kind of addicting drug, that includes nicotine, alcohol, all kinds of addictions, the brain learns, and they associate people, places, various cues with the use of the drug. So if we show these cues to somebody who's an alcoholic or an opiate addict, the brain is activated automatically. This happens whether you get group therapy or not. And, you know, so that's why we want to try to untrain the brain, and we use medications to block these effects. But it's not a lesion in the brain. It's actually a learned reflex in the brain.
And if you're talking about cues, it's visual, it's what, auditory, it's
smells, smell, odors. Yeah, that's nice. Right.
Well, you went cold turkey. Did you have to struggle with these so-called cues?
It's almost it's the same similarity as PTSD. You know, there's certain things you have to avoid. They always tell you avoid people, places, and things. It was difficult in the sense that sometimes the smell of matches used to make me nervous. Certain places made me nervous. I could go to a dinner party and if it was a bar restaurant and the restaurant was separated from it, I was okay. But if it was a typical a corner bar setting, I would get this thing in the pit of my stomach, and I would have to leave. I would have to excuse myself and say, I can't do this. I have to leave.
Wow. Does that go away?
It goes away with time, but it's this. One of the things is I spent 16 years using the feeling and the, that's it. Like you said, it's a learned behavior. It's been ingrained. So now you have to teach the brain and the body to get used to being sober and coping with certain feelings. And one of the things that occurs, like you were saying earlier, that people are not trained. You have psychologists, psychiatrists, therapists who don't realize that there is an anxiety, that a condition that people are born with. And then there's an anxiety that was induced as a result of, it's a chemical-induced anxiety, which at this point, as time goes on, the person has to get used to being drug-free. And not having it and all that dependency makes them anxious. They can't sleep, they can't eat, things. It takes a while to train the body so that food tastes good again, so that you can have a normal conversation and enjoy and have a quiet sleep without having to use medication to sleep, without having to, self-medicate. And some people don't. I went to a therapist when I came out. I spent the year with him. He kept insisting that I take Klonopins. And I used to say to him, I used to take 10, 15 at a time. You're going to set me off again. We argued one day, had a massive fight. I get home and turn on the news. He's on the news. He had stolen a license. He'd been practicing for 7 years.
Oh,
Dr.
Gosh.
Tremogli was his name. And it turned out that he was a fraud. But had I followed his guidance, because he was the therapist, God only knows where I'd be at right now.
Well, you also had a counselor that showed you how to game the system, right?
Yes. When I got arrested twice. The first time I got arrested, they gave me probation and they sent me to treatment, and I was still using. And the counselor that was assigned to me gave me she taught me how to get around the urines, because she said, well, if you're not going to stop using, the least you can do is get around the urine so you don't go to jail. Uh-huh. And she said, I'm still using myself, and And all she did was I would literally come in falling out, and they would do the urines, and they weren't able to. They kept saying, we know he's using. We just, the urines
couldn't
are clean.
The
so
evidence.
They couldn't get the evidence.
Kathy, your other son, as you said, has gone through rehab, gone through treatment. It sounds like it has been effective.
Yes.
From your perspective, how has he been able to be helped?
I think he just stayed, he went into an in-house rehab, came out, and did exactly what he was supposed to do. I think his brother was driving him to stay on the path of recovery. It's hard. It's one day at a time. He stayed in outpatient for nearly a year, and he stayed sober, and he's living a sober life. And like I said, it's a day-by-day struggle for him, I'm sure. But he's doing what he needs to do. And I think that's a lot of things family members don't really understand, the concept of sober life.
Oh.
Like, they feel that if your son's addicted, if it's okay if he drinks. And actually, I thought this, too, until I got educated. Or it's okay. Some people actually think it's okay to smoke, as long as they stay away from their drug of choice, which is wrong. They have to stay away from everything, because everything will lead them back to their drug of choice.
And what about the family? I mean, as a family, you have gone through this. You lost a son. You had a son who it sounds like he's doing a whole lot better, but certainly had addiction problems. What's been the effect on your family?
It's been very hard on the family.
I bet.
It's a struggle. It's like... my two youngest girls, I think they struggle all the time with it. I think there's the anger pops up every once in a while when things don't go right.
Anger at their brother?
Sometimes, yeah. Sometimes it is anger at the brother, and I don't think they know how to process that. I mean, I think we're doing the best we can. We're sticking as a family unit, but I can see things popping up. It's very hard on the – I mean, even the months leading up to the overdose incident, it's like – it's a nightmare because you don't know what's coming next. You don't know what to believe. You don't know what not to believe. You want to believe in your child, and you're not sure. You know, until you learn that the disease has just changed who they are until they get into the sobriety. Even now, like, he's doing really good, but yep. I'm still scared to death. Things creep up. Like, do I trust him? You know? But I can't interfere with his path. And that's hard to as a mother because you want to.
Of course.
But I can't interfere with his path of recovery.
And we're almost up in a break here. Does it help to – I mean, you're speaking very publicly here. Does it help you? Does it help the family to speak out?
It helps. It helps, yes. It helps tremendously.
To tell
the story and try to see if I can help somebody else. It's like David's guiding me to the path that I'm on. And if I can just help one person, it just – it's like I'm helping my day, and he's up there saying, go, Mom.
Well, let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation. That's Kathy Messina. She founded an organization called DAVE, D-A-V-E, Drug Addiction Overdose Education Incorporated, working to train organizations in Bucks County to distribute naloxone to friends and family members, those who are struggling with addiction. Elvis Rosado, education coordinator at Prevention Point Philadelphia, or Philly, a public health organization working to reduce the risk of drug use among high-risk populations. And Charles O'Brien, professor of psychiatry and the founding director of the Center for Studies of Addiction at the University of Pennsylvania. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. We're talking about heroin addiction, and one of the reasons is that Pennsylvania ranks number one in drug overdose deaths among young men ages 19 to 25. New Jersey is number four in the nation. And again, talking with Kathy Messina, Elvis Rosado, and Charles O'Brien. Let me read a comment from Anne, who says, make sure that your listeners understand that heroin addiction no longer affects the stereotypical bum on the street. We talked about that. She says, my son and many other young men are high school star athletes and scholars. Kids are much more susceptible if they start using substances, including alcohol, marijuana, at an early age. It's imperative that parents don't look the other way if their kids are using minor drugs. And Kathy, I'm going to toss that first back to you.
Yes, I totally agree that too many people are just taking a nonchalant attitude, and we really do need to open up our eyes. I told you that my son Dave, he was a football player, he was a baseball player, he was very involved. You would never have known. I mean, the church was packed on the day of his funeral from people that just loved and respected Dave. So we have to keep our eyes open as parents. Don't you know, especially with the minor drugs, as they so say, marijuana and stuff. People think it's just marijuana. It's okay. No, it's not. And we need to keep a vigilant on that.
You want to weigh in on that, Elvis?
I agree. One of the things that we need to be mindful of is that addiction has a higher prevalence in young people if they start before 18 than if they, for somebody, like, for instance, if they're drinking before the age of 18, there's a good probability that they're going to continue throughout the course of their life, you know, consuming alcohol, as opposed to if they've started in their mid 20s to late 20s, that it's not as not to say that there's not a percentage that are going to still drink, but there's a less probability of the addictive nature in the late ages with alcohol than there is at an earlier age.
Is that, Charles, I mean, from the kind of research looking, if we're talking about a sort of a brain disease or it affects the brain, a younger adolescent brain is more susceptible?
Just like a younger person can learn how to play baseball better, it lasts for a long time. So if you start smoking earlier, if you start drinking earlier, or if you use opioids earlier, you develop a very strong addiction. It's really hard to treat, and it keeps coming back. It's a lifelong disease, And another thing that your audience should know is that it's genetically determined.
Runs in families.
And genes play a major role. There have been a lot of studies trying to separate nature from nurture, the environment from the actual genes. And so that's why we're so strong on trying to find medications, because that can affect this biological component of addiction. So that's why, and of course, you have to use both the biology and the environment in the talk therapy.
Go ahead, Ellie.
I just wanted to say, and part of that heredity, you know, some people sometimes think also, if my father was an alcoholic, then I'm going to be an alcoholic. They don't, doesn't necessarily mean they're going to be addicted to the same substance. Some people may choose food, sex, smoking, gambling. It could be a number of other things. But the addictive, there's a, I believe it's a 4% higher probability that a child of an addict will, you know, have an addictive nature than one of parents that didn't have any type of addiction.
And you mentioned the fact, in, as a kid growing up, your two brothers didn't go down the same path as you.
Yes. But one of my brothers loves his games, baseball. He doesn't care what it is, you know, he's involved. So it does happen. I mean, and I think that's the other issue. The other issue is that if it's not a hard drug, we tend to, it's okay. You know, part of the, it's also ingrained in culture. Puerto Rico is a part of the United States. We're citizens. But the drinking age over there is 18. And it's 21 over here. And over there at 16 or 17, if they're drinking, parents go, he's almost legal anyway. So there's this tendency to think it's okay. It's only a beer or it's only alcohol. You know, at the age of 7 or 8 years old, my father would drink a case of beer. I would sit by him and he'd say, hey, go get me a beer. Can I have some? Sure. So I'd open it on the way. And by the time he drank a case of beer, I'd probably have drank a six pack.
Wow.
Because I opened up every single, I was 7 or 8 years old. I would open every single beer for him. And I would take some. So, you know, as time went on, I guess, you know, that's where the comfort grew and got into harder things. But
Kathy, you wanted to say something?
Just on the family thing. I think that's one of the biggest problems, the stigma on the family, because people are afraid to speak out. Like the very next morning after David passed, we got a phone call from the school because my kids all still went to the school. And the football coach said, what do you want me to tell? There's rumors going around. And right then and there, we said, tell the truth. Because if someone was going to pick, you wouldn't pick our family. Like, you know, and people out there who are not, I want to use the term ignorant, just want to say, well, they must have had this, or both parents aren't this, or, you know, and it's not true. There's so many families out there that are affected who are very good families, have come from very good backgrounds. And,
you know, thinking of the word denial, and oftentimes that's part of addiction, which is you sort of deny that you have a problem. And I wonder to you, Charles O'Brien, whether denial also includes the community or maybe even the country, a degree of denial about the problem of addiction.
Well, certainly the family. And as a matter of fact, in our training program for teaching people how to be therapists and how to treat the problem, we focus on family therapy. And another thing that I want to say about the genetic component is that we have about 23,000 genes, and we don't know how many are involved. We know 108 involved in schizophrenia recently came out, but there may be 50 or 100 genes involved in alcoholism or smoking. And so it's not a one-to-one. It's not like blue eyes, brown eyes. So the fact that some in a family will inherit the tendency and others won't. Some of the information we get comes from twin studies where you have identical twins who share the same genes and fraternal twins who are just like brother and sister. And it's the identical twins who have a very, very similar prevalence of addiction. Right. You know, so anyway, there are various ways that we can figure out, you know, how to incorporate the family factors into the treatment.
Have you had family therapy?
No. I think my cause is my therapy.
It's your therapy.
My daughter and I, we did go to some of the family sessions at the outpatient, right. And that helped a lot. But, you know,
yeah. I mean, it's not required, for sure. You know, something else I was thinking of, and this is maybe a more political question than a personal one, but it seemed when addiction and especially heroin was seen as a problem of the inner city, then we had zero tolerance. We locked people up. We treated them like criminals. And now that it's more in the suburbs, it's seen as a mental health issue or a public health issue and less a criminal issue. Elvis, I'm looking at you.
It's interesting because this is the only developed country that treats addiction as a crime. And it's, I think, for one of the biggest issues is it's so rampant. It is so rampant. It is so massive across the board that I honestly believe that if we decided to treat it as a disease, the government would probably feel responsible and necessary to treat it, and it would be such a, for them, they would see it as such a financial burden that they don't want to go down that road, you know, because, I mean, last year alone in this country, we had 49,000 overdose deaths due to opiate overdose, 70% of which was prescription medication. But it's something that people keep, you know, they keep taking money away, giving, you know, that there's not enough spaces in the treatment facilities. There's not enough being done. And you have, even in, and I worked at a facility where the amount of paperwork that we had to do was starting to trickle into the actual session to where sometimes the person was getting 15 minutes of actual therapy as opposed to the full hour. And
the rest taken up with paperwork or bureaucratic things.
And I ended up losing my job because I went to the top and I confronted them and I told them I felt like a street-level drug dealer because they were leaving the same way they were coming in. I was getting paid, they were getting paid, and the person wasn't being treated. So their response was, well, there's the door.
Well, and I wonder, I mean, I think it sounds like, Charles, that there's more understanding that addiction is a disease of the brain or something not about character so much. But at the same time, there is, I think, a disconnect between how we view addiction and how we treat addiction and how we fund addiction.
Right. Well, I totally agree with Elvis. So, you know, we're the only country that makes it a crime. And it's a medical problem. And there's a lot of evidence that when you treat it as a medical problem, you do a lot better. I think that when I first got into this field, it was just as, you know, it was data from the 1940s where all of the addicts were criminals, basically. And in the 1970s, when people started coming home from Vietnam with a heroin habit, we realized that it was something that was independent and it was like diabetes, high blood pressure, you know, was something that a person couldn't control.
Let me read a couple of comments here. Unfortunately, our phones are down, and that's why I'm going to read a couple of tweets here. This is a tweet from Murphy. How many people actually get 100% clean? Can't be more than 5%. When you're hooked, your life is over. I mean, that sounds like someone who has struggled with this issue. Elvis, you put that, your finger up
yes,
in the air.
Yes, because that's a very good point. But you have to realize also that there's two systems out there. So someone who is your average Joe who works at a factory or at a store or a supermarket, that type of population, yeah, probably about a 5% success rate. When you have individuals, lawyers, doctors, judges, and professionals who have that opportunity and they say, you need to take leave, you know, when they come back after 6 months, 8 months, or even a year, their profession is still there. They haven't officially lost everything. But you have individuals who may work in a factory who go to treatment, that job is gone. They've lost everything they had. The treatment facility now sets them loose, or the prison system lets them go. They're on the street. Yeah. No job, no education, no income. They've lost family and everything else. So the probability of that person returning to their addiction is very high because they're stuck. So yes, depending on the success rate among professionals, licensed professionals, I think it's probably about 40 or 50%, maybe even more. But with your average individual, yeah, probably about 5%.
A number of comments here saying, well, let's just legalize or decriminalize all drugs. There's certainly states that have taken some steps when it comes to marijuana. You all had a reaction here. Kathy, let me start with you. But I see several comments here saying, you know, let's just legalize drugs and then we won't have to deal with this problem. I'm overstating that a little bit, but what do you think?
I don't know. I just totally disagree with that. I just think that that's just given a free-for-all.
I don't think legalizing anything is going to, you know, it's just putting Band-Aid on something. It's the addiction, if you're going to have an addictive, you know, the addiction's still going to be there. And the death rate, I think the death rate would rise because now you're saying it's okay to do it. So you're going to do it more. And, I totally disagree with
that. What do you think about that, Charles?
It depends on the drug, because clearly these drugs are dangerous. And, you know, we still haven't figured out the best way to handle marijuana. It has some good aspects and a lot of bad aspects. It's very hard to treat marijuana addiction. I think the one thing that hasn't come out in this conversation so far is that the original recent epidemic seemed to start around the time we were increasing our concern about treating pain, and that was a good thing. But sometimes when you try to do something good, something bad comes out of it. And the whole idea of opioids, the teenager finds them in the grandparents' medicine cabinet, you know, it's got a doctor's name on it, think it's safe, and in fact it's a prescription opioid, and it's just as dangerous as heroin. And so we have to understand that an opiate, depending on whether it comes from the plant or not, it fits at the exact same receptor in the brain, and they're just as dangerous.
Go ahead, Elvis.
I agree with the doctor because you know, most people may not know this, but cocaine was legal at one point in this country. It was sold over the counter. And there was a reason why they, you know, they took it off and they made it illegal again. And there's countries that are using heroin. They're using opiates directly to treat heroin addicts, but it's being used from a medical standpoint. It's being controlled. It's being administered at a medical level. But I agree. I mean, I think that legalizing something like heroin or cocaine especially is you're asking for trouble because the amount you can overdose from alcohol, but at a huge amount of consumption, depending on, you know, who you are. But it's very easy to overdose for opiates. And then, you know, how are you going to set an age as far as what age you can start using something like that? I mean, there's just so much behind it that it is going to fail that. I'm scared to hear, you know, even the whole issue of marijuana. You know, he mentioned marijuana addiction. When I was growing up in the 70s, marijuana was a totally different monster, that creature than from what it is today. There's so many more chemicals. There's over 300 more chemicals today in it than ever before. They've taken pages from the tobacco industry where they've sprayed it with ammonia to make it addictive. And, you know, we had kids used to come into treatment who were only smoking marijuana, and yet they had opiates and benzos and everything in their systems because it was being sprayed, or what they call hydro, where they use water to grow it, and whatever chemical they put into that water grows into that plant. And there's a higher level. You have people nowadays that are saying, I can't stop smoking marijuana. So the potency in the chemicals are greater today, and it's a danger if you legalize it.
Well, we just touched the surface, and my thanks to all three of you for joining us today in Radio Times. Elvis Rosado, thank you very much.
Pleasure.
And he's education coordinator at Prevention Point Philly.
Philadelphia.
Okay, sorry.
It's okay.
Prevention Point Philadelphia. Kathy Messina, thank you very much as well.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Founder of Dave Drug Addiction Overdose Education Incorporated. And Charles O'Brien, thank you for joining us on Radio Times as well. He's a professor of psychiatry, the founding director of the Center for Studies of Addiction at the University of Pennsylvania. And my apologies to our listeners. Our phones are down once again. We had some comments here, but we do appreciate you joining us on Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thanks for joining us in this first hour. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.